All right, Numbers chapter 7 is where we find ourselves. We're working through the section really now where we're getting ready to go. we're getting ready to leave Sinai, getting ready to head toward the promised land, but there are some things that need to happen first, some things that need to take place. As we figure out kind of a timeline, it's important to recognize the first several chapters of Numbers aren't necessarily chronological as they're laid out. That's not what happens here. In fact, what happens here in Numbers chapter 7 comes shortly after the end of Leviticus, after the tabernacle is completed, after all the offerings have been given for that, for the actual construction of the tabernacle, and all the work has been done, all the workmanship has been accomplished, then we have what happens here in Numbers chapter 7. And really it is about the gifts that the people give. It's interesting contrast, and I think that while Moses is writing the book of Numbers, he's doing it more on a thematic basis than necessarily a chronological basis, because if you remember, what he's just gotten through with in chapter 6 is he's gotten through the Nazirite vow, he's gotten through really the dedication of people, God for his people, and how he should be worshipped, to him alone. He's talked about, he's just gotten through with the Aaronic blessing, where the people are blessed through and by God and by God alone. And as he finishes that, then he contrasts that with what happens then in chapter 7, what he talks about in chapter 7. While chapter 6, the end of chapter 6, is God's blessing for his people, chapter 7 really is the people's blessing to God, and how the people then respond to God and what he calls them to. We started this last time as we looked at the dedication of the tabernacle. These really are more than the dedication of the tabernacle. These are the gifts for the tabernacle. Starts off with some carts that show up. Not just show up. Some of the tribal leaders come and they bring carts. Carts that were intended, they were in their original state, they were just carts that were used for whatever carts were used for, but these carts were brought for the specific purpose of being dedicated to God, being given to him for the specific purpose of moving the tabernacle from place to place. Remember, the tabernacle is a mobile unit. It is God's mobile home, if you will. It's where he's going to dwell as the people move around. And I believe the initial intention of God was to be present all throughout Israel and to move. That's why the tabernacle was established the way that it was, so that it would not be necessarily one place, but God could be moved wherever his presence went and would go there. Because remember, while it does work really well for 40 years of wandering, that wasn't necessarily the first plan. The first plan was for 11 days of wandering, and then in the land. That's what the first plan was. But the people, we get to Numbers 13, we'll figure out why that doesn't happen. But I believe that this tabernacle was intended for, built for mobility, so that there wouldn't necessarily be one place. Now we know that God has his mind set on one place, Jerusalem, Mount Zion, and he's gonna accomplish and get that through David, and there's gonna be that permanent place set up for him. But I think that there's also the idea that with the tabernacle that God wasn't just going to be in one place, in one city, but he's going to be moving around and mobile through. In fact, the language he uses is wherever I choose to set my name, wherever I choose to put my name, that's where they were supposed to go. So it wasn't necessarily, as the law was originally written, it wasn't necessarily everybody went to Jerusalem three times a year. They went to wherever the tabernacle was three times a year. That was what drew them together wasn't a city. What drew them together was the presence of God in the tabernacle. That's what drew them together. So, but as it's designed then, it was designed to be taken apart, taken down, packed up, loaded up, and moved. Some of the stuff would have been rather large, would have been rather hard to carry, and so these carts are provided for that to happen. Two of the folks get the ability to use carts, but the Kohathites, they don't get to use carts, if you remember why, because they're carrying the actual the Ark of the Covenant and the actual furniture inside the Ark. It's inside the tabernacle, and that was not to be placed on carts. That was to be carried with poles. And it was specifically designed and said how they were going to carry that. So they don't get cards. They don't get cards. But the two other groups, the Gershonites and the Merarites, both get cards. But the Kohathites, they don't get cards. So and we talked about that last time. So that's your review. Now we're going to jump in and move forward. Now we have a 12-day give fest, if you will. A 12-day festival of giving led by the chiefs of the tribes of Israel. If you're doing your regular Bible reading, when you get to Numbers chapter 7, starting at verse 12, it's a bogged down kind of place. Why do I say that? Because you have the only difference you have between Numbers in Numbers 7, 12 through Numbers 7, 83? The only difference you have is on the first day, second day, third day, a name and a tribe. Everything else is exactly the same. Everything else is, so I will read for you the entire chapter 7 from verse 12 through 83. I'm going to read the entire thing for you in a nutshell. He who offered his offering on the blank day was blank, the son of blank, the tribe of blank. And his offering was one silver plate whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver basin of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them for full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one golden dish of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull from the herd, one ram, one male lamb, a year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for a sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, a year old. This was the offering of blank, the son of blank. Do that 12 times. Do that 12 times, and you read Numbers chapter 7, verse 12 through 83. Why couldn't Moses just have said, all the tribes, all the folks brought this offering in consecutive days, and here's the offering? Oh, wait, he does that. He actually does that. Verse 84. This was the dedication for the altar on the day that was anointed from the chase of Israel. 12 silver plates, 12 silver basins, 12 gold dishes, each plate weighing 130 shekels, and each basin 70. Silver vessels, 2,400 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. And he goes and he lists the total right there as you get to the end. So why didn't he just list the total and say every one of the guys gave something? Because I think if he just lists the total, you miss the pageantry. You miss the ceremony. You miss the circumstance. And I think that's really important as we walk through what he's doing. I don't think it's an accident or Moses is just, you know, when I was, you've done this. When you were in high school or college, you know you were assigned, I want a paper of 1,200 words, right? And so, do we count and the as our 1,200 words? No. Oh boy, if I can't count and in the, I've got to figure out how to fill up some space. Is that what Moses is doing here? Does Moses have, a 5,000 word paper to write and he's got to fill up 1,000 words here with this going over and over? Because it's not the same information. It's a different guy giving it on a different day from a different tribe. Just so happens he gives the same thing. So maybe he's just filling space that way. I don't think that's what he's doing at all. I think in light of what we've just learned, in light of just having understood the blessing of God for his people, I think there's this emphasis on the circumstances, emphasis on the ceremony of these gifts of being given the way they were. And I think it's a crescendo. I think it starts off with the first guy on the first day from the tribe of Judah and ends on the last day with the 12th guy on the 12th day. Let's see, what tribe is he from? From the tribe of Naphtali. I think it builds, and so it's this, by the time you get by the time you get to tribe number 7 or tribe number 8, there's anticipation. It's almost our turn. We're going to get to give. It's almost our turn. We're going to get to give this to God. And I think there's this crescendo building of the people now dedicating themselves, not through just the stuff they're giving, but dedicating their hearts to follow God. This is important because it doesn't happen very often. This kind of response in Israel does not happen very often. In fact, this is a rare response in Israel. In fact, if you were to actually go through from Exodus through Deuteronomy and look at the times that Israel responded well, Israel responded with excitement for worship and with eagerness for worship and through the ceremony of worship. Compare that against the times when Israel murmured and complained and griped and didn't do it. Actually, when Israel goes after foreign gods and foreign wives and does all this stuff, the times when they do it right, when they get it right, are so insignificant as compared to the times that they don't. So I think that's one of the reasons that Moses is writing this out the way he does, is just to herald for the people the excitement of this giving to the Lord. Of them preparing for what was going to happen. Yes, Steve.
Quick question. It seems like there's 12 days, 12 tribes, so it should be one per tribe, right?
Uh-huh.
What's the Naphtha or whatever? These aren't the 12 tribes.
Yes, Sarah.
They are?
Yeah, every one of the tribes. Every one of them is a 12. They're one of the 12 tribes. I would say 12 sons of Jacob, but they're not the 12 sons of Jacob. There are 11 sons of Jacob. Actually, there are 10 sons of Jacob and 2 sons of Joseph. You've got... well, you've got the head of the tribe whose son, who his dad is, and the tribe he's from. Let me walk it through. Just verse 12. The first day is Nashon, the son of Abinadab of the tribe of Judah. That's first. Second day, Nathanael of Zuar of Issachar. That's the second. Third day is Eliab, the son of Helon, the chief of the people of Zebulun. Fourth day, Eleazar, the son of Shadir, the chief people of Reuben. Fifth day, Shelumiel, son of Zershaddai, of Simeon. Sixth day is Eliasaph, the son of Duel, the chief of Gad. Seventh day, Elishama, the son of... See, you did that on purpose. You just... You cheater. I never liked you in the first place. Amihud, the chief of Ephraim. Eighth day, Gamaliel. I can get that one. Gamaliel, son of Pedazur, of the people of Manasseh. Ninth day, Abidian, son of Gideon, the chief of Benjamin. Tenth day, Ahazir, son of Mamashaddai, chief of the people of Dan. And 11th day is Pegiel, son of Okran, the chief people of Asher. And finally, you get to 12th day, Ahir, the son of Enan, chief people of Naphtali. Those are the 12 tribes, with the exception of Levi. Levi didn't give. Levi, the whole tribe, Levi, has been given and dedicated. Actually, Numbers 8, we're going to actually see the dedication of Levi. They don't get left out. They do get to do something, okay? So that's where they're the 12 tribes. And we'll talk about that in just a second. Go ahead, John. Yeah, I think there isn't necessarily a statement that Moses said, you must bring this offering and here's what I want it to look like. I don't see that happening. What we do see is, you know, it starts off with Judah. So let me step back. When and how did this happen? Well, if you look at the way the tribes are listed, in the 12 things, they're listed exactly as they were spaced around the tabernacle. They're listed in exactly that order, starting on the east, moving around to the west. That's exactly the order, moving around to the south. That's exactly the order they're found in, okay? So that's what started it. And it's interesting, it's important, it starts with Judah. Based on Jacob's blessing back in Genesis chapter 49, Jacob blessed Judah as the one who would lead the people, if you recall that. because of Reuben's failure in leadership and Reuben's incest with his stepmom, because of that, the leadership doesn't pass to Reuben as the firstborn. Because of Levi's and Simeon's treachery with Shechem, what they did to Shechem, it doesn't go through them, and so Judah's next. And so Jacob blesses Judah and says Judah will be the one to lead. Well, where they're how they're outlined or how they're organized around the tabernacle, Judah's the first tribe, and it's interesting, Judah's the one who brings this gift. I think there's a movement of God that encourages or that does this. I don't know that. Here's why. This seems to be an offering, a free will kind of offering, not a required kind of offering. There doesn't seem to be any place where God says, here's what you're supposed to bring. He does say this. He says, verse 10, the chiefs offered offerings for the dedication of the altar on the day it was anointed. The chiefs offered their offerings before the altar, and the Lord said to Moses, they shall offer their offerings one chief each day for the dedication of the altar. Doesn't say what the offering is specifically supposed to be, but it does say they're supposed to bring an offering, and they're supposed to offer it one day after the other for the next 12 days. That's what they're supposed to do. It is a great question. So how do they all figure out, how do they all give the exact same thing? Was there some kind of prescription for that, or was it just a movement of the Spirit in their heart to cause them to do that? The answer to that question is, I don't know. I don't know, because we don't have any kind of a clue that there was a prescription given for the offering. Well, that seems kind of weird that they would all give the exact same thing, doesn't it? Well, does it seem kind of weird that a Red Sea would part? Does it seem just a little strange that manna would fall from heaven every day except on Saturday? Does it seem just a little strange that you smack a rock and water flows out of it? This movement of God in the heads of the tribes is insignificant compared to some of the stuff he's already done. So I'm not willing to discount it as Moses said, bring this. I'm not willing to discount that. I think even in that, there's miraculous going on. There's miraculous going on because we see a movement of God in the heads of these tribes that they did exactly what John said. So it wasn't one tribe like Judah, who is the chief, didn't bring twice of what everybody else brought and said, look at us. We're a very special tribe. We got the good stuff. No, but there seems to be this equality in the gift they give. In fact, it doesn't seem to be. They give exactly the same gift. Did all the trays look alike? I have no idea if all the trays looked alike. Did all the golden bowls look like the exact golden bowl? I don't know what the bowls looked like. I can tell you this, they all weighed the same amount and were valued by weight the same way. There have been a lot of folks who have tried to say, well, how much would that gift cost? Would that gift be worth in U.S. dollars today? Well, it's really not, you really can't compare apples to, it's not an apples to apples. Because in their day, because of the scarcity of silver and the scarcity of gold, likely gold and silver were almost of equal value in that day. So it really was, it's really almost impossible to get an accurate valuation of how much the gift was. But it was huge. It was huge. Not because of the kind or the amount of gift, but because of the heart that led to that gift and what the people were saying. And because of this, again, I think if we read it, and we usually read it in one sitting, and we read it one setting, and we read it super quick because it's the same thing over and over and over again. So basically, I'm reading it so I can get this box checked, get on with my day because it says the same thing. Okay, 12 plates, 12 bowls, 12 bowls, 12. I get it. So we miss the circumstance and the pomp of the chief of the tribe gathering all of this together and going as that tribal representative to the tabernacle and bringing with him all of this stuff. Think of this. He's got a bowl. He's got silver plates. He's got behind him a bowl. He's got behind them what are those called? Goats. He's got rams. He's got this whole stuff trailing him, bringing it to the door of the tabernacle and laying that then at Moses and Aaron's feet as a gift for worship. And I think there's probably a day of celebration for that tribe. And as there's celebration for the tribe of Judah, the next day, the next tribe says, hey, you know what? It's our day tomorrow. We get to do it. It's like Christmas in reverse. Like, we get to give this to our God as a representative of our tribe. We're doing this. And it goes for 12 days of this opportunity to give. And so it's a big deal. Yeah, David. Yeah, it very well could be. In fact, I would lean that way. And here's the exciting part about that. If there's no prescription for the gift, if Moses didn't say, bring one silver bowl, one silver plate, all this, and by the time you get to day four, and you're looking at the list, and on day four you see, hey, he's bringing. A silver plate whose weight is 130 shekels, a silver basin of 70 shekels, full of the same stuff, a golden dish, a golden bowl of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, all this stuff. Do you think that maybe there's, wow, this is more than coincidence. This is God at work in us. And by the time you get to day 12, by the time old Naphtali finally gets up there and they give theirs, it's like, wow, this is amazing. And I think it's amazing because what it showed for the nation was unity. It showed unity. The nation is not terribly unified throughout its history. One of the things that is, if you continue reading in the land through Judges, you'll see division is rampant. You'll see civil war. You'll see Ephraim going up against his brothers. You'll see Dan, when Dan can't take his own property, can't take his own land, he goes up and steals some from his brothers. You see infighting. You see, I mean, we got this idea because of Sunday school, because of the Sunday school lessons we were taught when we were kids. We got this idea that Joshua did this great thing. Joshua, they conquered. They went in. They had the land. They went home. And now life was great. They lived great in the land. And they, you know, they were brothers. They were a band of brothers. They were just all happy people, happy day. But you can't do that if you read Judges. Because if you read Judges, you realize they weren't really happy at all. They weren't really unified at all. In fact, even as they come to the place where they're trying to choose a king with Saul and then with David. Remember, David actually becomes king of Judah years before he becomes king of all the nation. And in fact, if you recall, after Saul dies, there is a power struggle between one of Saul's sons, Shimei, and David himself. There's this struggle that goes on. They are not a let's get together and be, you know, 13 original colonies and 12 original tribes, and we got this one great nation. No, they're a very loose confederation at all. But here, in this day, on these 12 days, this little short time of 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks, they were unified in giving to the temple and tabernacle. Okay, for now on, if I say temple, you know I mean tabernacle. In giving to the tabernacle, they are unified, and their gifts were the same. And it is, when all totaled, a huge offering, a huge gift that they give as a whole. And I think it's a bellwether day in their history, because as you get to the end and you look at what the total gift was, I'm just going to read it again. I'll read it slowly so that we can hear. And I would just imagine the stack up here and what would be up here waiting. This was the dedication offering for the altar on the day it was anointed. From the chiefs of Israel, 12 silver plates, 12 silver basins, 12 golden dishes, each silver plate weighing 130 shekels, each basin 70. The silver vessels, all the silver vessels, 2,400 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Now, what is the shekel of sanctuary? I should say that too. Shekel of sanctuary is a heavier shekel than a normal shekel. Okay. A normal shekel seems to have been about a half shekel weight. I don't understand how that works, but the reading I did showed the temple, the sanctuary shekel weighed about twice as much as the normal shekel of the day weighed. So I don't know why, but it's actually defined here for us as a temple, a shekel of the sanctuary. It's a heavier shekel. And I don't think it's like heavy water or anything heavy carbon that's in, you know, it's not like a nuclear war bomb. I think that's what we're talking about here. It doesn't have an extra proton. It's just got extra weight. So, where was it? According to the shekel of the sanctuary, 12 golden dishes full of incense weighing 10 shekels apiece, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, all the gold dishes being 120 shekels. All the cattle for the burnt offering, 12 bulls, 12 rams, 12 male lambs, a year old with the grain offering, and 12 male goats for a sin offering. All the cattle for the sacrifice of peace offerings, 24 bulls, 60 rams, the male goats 60, the male lambs a year old 60. It was a dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. So that's the gift, 60 rams, 60, just a huge offering, just a huge offering. And that's not even the biggest offering that's ever offered. There are actually larger offerings than that given. But this is a specific offering for the dedication. So imagine these 12 days of this, the anticipation, and then you have verse 89. I think verse 89 is significant. Verse 89 is significant because the people have brought these offerings over the last 12 days. Last 12 days, and it doesn't say anything about God's acceptance of that offering. It doesn't say, and God accepted the offering. It doesn't say, and you know, fire came down from heaven and God said, this is the my beloved offering in whom I am well pleased. It doesn't say anything like that. There's nothing said like that. At this point, for that 12 days when the people of Israel are bringing these things in, they're bringing these gifts, they're bringing these offerings, for the most part, God himself is silent. God himself is silent. But then we have verse 89. Verse 89 is super significant, I think. Because when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak to the Lord, he heard the voice of him, voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony from between the cherubim, and it spoke to him. I think that is, this is my nation in whom I'm well pleased. I think that was the indication that God said, good job. Good job. I'm pleased with this offering. I'm pleased with this offering. It's a dedication of this place. And so I think after you walk through the incredible gifts that are there, the heart that's there, really in some sense I believe the miracle of this offering, at the end of it God says, I think, well done. Because while they're waiting, while they're anticipating, Moses goes in and God speaks. God speaks. So we have I think verse 89 of chapter 7 is the acceptance of the offering. So that gets us through chapter 7. Any questions, any comments, any statements, any debate? I'm not going to debate anybody. All right, let's move forward. Chapter 8. Chapter 8, we have the setting up of the lamps. First, and now we're going to go through a section that feels at times disjointed, and I just have to tell you, it feels that way. So I don't know how it all fits together. I don't know why you have the dedication offering given. God speaks to Moses, and then we jump from there to, oh, and by the way, here's how you set up the lamps. I'm not sure how we get. I'm sure it's here for a purpose. I haven't determined what the purpose is. I'm just telling you that outright. But now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, and so as you're reading Numbers, every time you read the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, don't read that as next thing that happened. The Lord spoke to Moses. Read that as the next thing Moses wants to talk about is this. That's how it transitions. It's not necessarily a chronological transition, as it is in a transition of ideas or theme. So he's transitioning away from the dedication now to some of the service and how it works. And the thing I think is he's going to go from the lamps to the Levites, and really it's the lamps inside the holy place that allow the Levites, the priests, to be able to do their job, tending to stuff. So that might be the idea here. But that's just a might be. I don't even like that idea, but that's the one I came up with. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, the seven lamps that shall give light in front of the lampstand, and Aaron did so. He set up its lamps in front of the lampstand as the Lord commanded Moses. And this was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold from its base to its flowers. It was hammered work according to the pattern that the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand." It's interesting to me, the lampstand gets its own section here. The table of showbread doesn't get a section. The altar of incense doesn't get a section. Those are the other pieces that are in other pieces of furniture that are in the holy place. He doesn't give special treatment here in the book of Numbers for the altar of incense. He doesn't give special treatment here in the book of Numbers for the table of showbread, but he does for the lampstand. And he goes over again how the lampstand is even supposed to be made. We've already heard this, right? We heard this back in Exodus when Moses gets the pattern from God about how to build the lampstand. We already had this. But for some reason, he says it again. So it's there. And for some reason, Ron? Right. Right. Yeah.
These aren't candlesticks. They're oil basins.
Right.
And so they're oil basins that in some form or another, maybe because of reflectors at the back or something, they're casting the light.
Yep. Yeah, so I don't know if you heard Ron or not, but what basically is being said, and I did want to explain that, is how do you put the lamps in front of the lampstand if they're on the lampstand? How does that make sense? But the idea is have the lamps facing front so the front of the lampstand is lit. That's the idea here. And he also said this isn't candlestick, and that's good. I think maybe King James translate this as the golden candlestick. Well, their candlesticks didn't even come to be until, you know, the Middle Ages. So this isn't a candlestick. This is a lampstand. There are seven bowls of oil that have wicks that are trimmed, and how it's taken care of, we've already heard. We've already heard how the Levites take care of the lamps, how the priests take care of the lamps. We've already heard that. But that's what's going on. Again, though, why here? Why now? These are the kind of questions I ask myself when I'm reading. I like to ask why here, why now? And I don't know. I don't know why here, why now. I haven't got there yet. David Henseling?
Do you see any connection here with the seven lampstands in Revelation chapter 1?
The question is, do I see any connection here with the seven lampstands here in Revelation, seven lamps in Revelation? I always see correlation there. Boy. 7 minutes. One for each lampstand. I don't have time to do that. I'll answer that next week. I will talk about that next week. That's a really good question. And I think that because of the language here and because of the language there, there has to be correlation. And I'll tell you what I think that is next. I can't do it well in less than 10 minutes. I probably need... That'll be next week's class, probably, but that'll be what we talk about. Good question. Hadn't thought about going there, but we're going to go there now. So we'll talk about that next week. Let's move on. Move on this morning. See if we can get through the cleansing Levites. So the next big section of chapter 8 from chapter 8, verse 5 through the end of the chapter, is concerning Levites. Concerning Levites, the Levites. This is also a restatement of things we've already heard. But I think this is important because now, at this point, when we're here in Numbers, the tabernacle is set up, the tabernacle is dedicated, the gifts have been given, the lamp is lit, all this stuff is going on, and now we're getting ready to move, and there is a rehearsal of or a retelling of the requirements for and what the Levites are supposed to be and how they're supposed to serve. And I think he does that on purpose right here just before they get ready to go, because they're just about ready. They're just about ready to take off. And so as the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites from among the people of Israel and cleanse them. Thus you shall do to cleanse them. Sprinkle the water purification upon them. Let them go without a razor over all their with a razor over all their body, and wash their clothes and cleanse themselves." So sprinkle them with holy water. They get a good shave all over the place. They go wash with water. They cleanse themselves. Then take a bull from their herd and its grain offering of fine flour mixed with oil, and you shall take another bull from the herd for a sin offering. You shall bring the Levites before the tent of meeting and assemble the whole congregation of the people of Israel. And when you do that, the people of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites and shall offer Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the people of Israel, that they may do service to the Lord. So now the Levites have been set aside by God. They've been consecrated by the people. Now they're going to actually be sent as a wave offering. You didn't throw a wave offering on the altar. If they had been a burnt offering, we wouldn't have many Levites left. They're a wave offering where they're waved at, waved before God as showing the dedication to them. It's not a heave offering. Heave goes like this, wave goes like this. So they're a wave offering. I don't think that meant Aaron picked up every Levite. I think he'd get a little tired after the end of the day on that one. But I think it was symbolically they were given as a wave offering for debt. They were given for service. They were given for service. they're to be separated. They were wholly given to the God. These are just some things for there. And then verse 17, I think, is a significant verse. He says, "For all the firstborn among the people of Israel are mine, both man and beast. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn land of Egypt, I consecrated them for myself." And he says, "And I have taken the Levites instead of all the firstborn among the people of Israel." If you recall, Passover, first Passover in Egypt, God killed the firstborn of Egypt, but he spared the firstborn of Israel because of the blood that was sprinkled on the doorposts. He spared them. Because of that, if they did the count of the firstborn coming out, was right at 22,000. They did a count of the Levites, 22,000. God said, "Okay, you get your firstborn, I get the Levites." So he took them as his own because of the work that he did getting them out of Israel. And he shows them that then that's their responsibility. Their responsibility is to be there in service. as you get to the end of chapter 8, there's actually a retirement plan. The Levites are the one group in Israel that had a retirement plan. Believe it or not, they were able to retire. As the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This applies to Levites from 25 years old and upward. They shall come and do the service of the tent of the meeting. From the age of 50 years, they shall withdraw from the duty of the service and serve no more. They minister to their brothers in the tent of meeting by keeping guard, but they do no service. Thus you shall do to the Levites in assigning their duties." So a Levite checked in when he was 25 years old, served for 25 years, 50th birthday, he retired. He retired. So the first retirement program in the Word. And that's the only, it's interesting, that is the only retirement program. I tried to find, is there any place where a farmer gets to retire? Any place where, no, it's not listed anywhere. The only group of people who were ever given a retirement program was the Levites. Go ahead, Ron. He's trying to steal my thunder. No, they didn't actually get to just go out, you know, and travel. It wasn't like, okay, we're going to Bahamas. It wasn't what they did, you know, they didn't, that wasn't it. They didn't get to, you know, here's your free camel, take off and ride. They had a purpose, but they didn't actually do service in the tabernacle. They weren't actually doing the labor. They were actually standing guard, actually helping. It says they're ministering to their brothers. So they weren't retired. But as far as the actual service of the temple goes, they were retired from that. They were not doing the actual offering of the sacrifices anymore. They weren't actually doing any of that. They're in some sense retired from that. And again, they're the only group of people that's ever said they can go and just stand watch and be helpful. Everybody else kept working. Good? Okay. Yeah, that with the goat. What time is it? Okay, we got to stop. Almost. So that we'll call that the Levites. So next week, what we'll do is I will step back and we'll talk about the lampstands. We'll talk about the seven here and the seven in Revelation, and look at the significance there, because I do think there's a correlation. I don't think they're exactly. I don't think the seven lampstands are the seven. The same exact thing, but I think there's a correlation there that I will draw, and it's a spiritual deal. So we'll talk about that, and then we'll get into the celebration of Passover, because we're just about ready to go. The people of Israel are just about ready to leave Sinai. They're on the verge of heading out of here and heading for the promised land. Think about this: they are 11 days away. 11 days away. If you're now a child of Israel, you've gotten through all this stuff. You've gotten the law. You've been at the foot of Sinai for nearly a year and a half. You're there. You've got everything done. The tabernacle is built. You know where you stand. You know where you sit. The gifts have been given. The priests are set up. The Levites are ready to go. You're ready to go. You're gonna celebrate Passover, and you're gonna take off. And in 11 days. You're going to be no longer slaves. You're going to be going in to possess a land. That's a big deal. That's a big deal. And 40 years later, they finally get there. Man, Numbers 13 shouldn't be in the Bible. Let's not get out of there. So, I just wanted to build some anticipation, because that's what's got to be going on in Israel right now. They got to be building some anticipation to no longer be slaves, no longer be sitting at Sinai, but to be in the land God promised them, where he said, you'll be my people and I'll be your God. It's excitement. It should be exciting for them. Yeah, it is 40 years of Groundhog Day. Let's pray and I'll let you go. Lord, thank you so much for your word, for the truth that's there. Thank you for just the privilege you give us to serve you. Pray you'd help us to, especially this morning, as we do one of the ceremonies of the church, that it wouldn't be just about checking a box for us as we take communion, but it would be about celebrating the amazing gift you've given us, the way you've gave yourself, and that we would then in turn be willing to give ourselves completely for you. Lord, thank you for the time together in your word this morning, and go with us. We ask this in your name. Amen.